Hey everyone, ready for another deep dive? Today, we're going to tackle a Supreme Court case that's, it's a bit of a head-scratcher. It's Michigan v. Bryant, and it really digs into the whole mess of dying declarations and the Confrontation Clause.
I've heard of that one. It's pretty controversial, right?
You bet. Even the justices themselves were split on this one. So to get through this, we've got a case brief and some excerpts from the opinions.
Sounds like a recipe for some serious legal drama.
You got it. Picture this. Middle of the night in Detroit. Police find Anthony Covington. He's badly wounded in a gas station parking lot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And sadly, he dies. But not before telling the officers that Rick shot him.
Okay.
Later on, police find evidence linking a Rick Bryant to the crime. Seems straightforward, right?
Yeah, you'd think so.
But there's a catch. This all went down before the Crawford v. Washington case, which, you know, really shook things up when it comes to out-of-court statements.
Right. Crawford really set a much higher bar for using those kinds of statements, especially if the person who made them can't testify.
Exactly. And in this case, the Michigan Supreme Court actually overturned Bryant's conviction. They said Covington's statement shouldn't have been allowed in court at all.
Wow. So the Supreme Court had to step in and sort it all out.
They did. But before we get into all the nitty-gritty, can you give us a quick refresher on the Confrontation Clause?
Of course. So the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause, it basically gives a criminal defendant the right to confront their accusers in court.
Okay.
Traditionally, that meant actually being physically present.
Right. Makes sense.
But over time, it's come to include this right to challenge out-of-court statements, too, especially if they're what we call testimonial in nature.
Okay. And that's where things start to get a little fizzy.
Right.
What exactly makes a statement testimonial?
That is the million-dollar question, and the courts wrestled with it a lot. A key case that helps define it is Davis v. Washington.
Okay.
This case established what we call the primary purpose test.
The primary purpose test.
Yeah. Basically, if a statement's main purpose is to help police gather evidence for a prosecution, well, it's probably considered testimonial. And that means it's subject to much stricter rules about whether it can be used in court.
So like a formal interrogation down at the police station.
Exactly. But Davis also said that statements made during an ongoing emergency where the main purpose is to deal with that emergency, those aren't considered testimonial.
So a 911 call in the middle of a crime,
yeah,
that would probably be admissible.
Right. In those cases, the focus is on stopping the danger, not building a case for later.
Gotcha. So back to Michigan v. Bryant, where does Covington's statement fit into all of this?
Well, that was the big question for the court. Was Covington talking to the police during an ongoing emergency, or was his main goal to point the finger at Bryant as the shooter?
And what did they decide?
Well, this is where it gets interesting. It was a split decision. The majority opinion written by Justice Sotomayor argued that the questioning of Covington did fall under that ongoing emergency exception. They said a shooter on the loose is a threat to everybody. Right? So the police were still trying to resolve the crisis.
Even though Covington himself was safe with the police.
Exactly. The danger to the public was still considered ongoing.
Okay. But what about the other justices?
Well, the dissents written by Justices Scalia and Ginsburg, they've really disagreed with this interpretation.
No, I bet.
They argued that from Covington's point of view, the emergency was over. He was with the police, and his main aim was to name his attacker.
So we've got a real clash of perspectives here. It seems like the whole definition of an ongoing emergency is at the heart of this disagreement.
Absolutely. And that's the big question that comes out of Bryant. How far can this ongoing emergency exception really stretch? Where do we draw the line?
Yeah, it feels like we're wading into some pretty murky legal waters here. How did the court justify this broader view of an ongoing emergency then?
Well, they really emphasized that it's not just about the victim's immediate safety anymore. You know, they highlighted the need to protect the police, the public, everyone. So, for example, they argued that the type of weapon involved that makes a difference.
Oh, interesting.
Like a gun with its wider range of danger that creates a bigger zone of emergency than, say, a fistfight.
So a situation with a firearm that's more likely to be seen as an ongoing emergency, even if the victim themselves is out of immediate danger.
Yeah, that seems to be their thinking. And they also pointed out that, you know, emergencies can evolve.
Right.
What starts as a clear emergency could turn into a more standard investigation. And that can make things really blurry.
Yeah, I can see how that would lead to some tough calls. But let's go back to the dissents for a minute. You mentioned Justice Scalia. Did he buy this broader interpretation of ongoing emergency?
Not at all. In his dissent, Justice Scalia, he didn't hold back. He basically accused the majority of just making up an emergency to let Covington's statement in.
Wow.
He argued that the police, you know, they were clearly focused on building a case against Bryant, not responding to some immediate threat.
So he was firmly in the camp that Covington's statement was purely testimonial and should have been thrown out.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Justice Thomas. While he agreed that the statement was admissible, he focused on something different, the whole informality of the questioning.
Yeah.
He argued because the police weren't doing like a structured interrogation in a controlled setting.
Right.
Covington's statement, it didn't have that same kind of solemnity that usually marks testimonial statements.
So the setting, the way the questions were asked, played a big role in his analysis.
Yes. For Justice Thomas, the less formal things are, the less likely a statement is to be seen as purely testimonial. And then there's Justice Ginsburg's dissent, which brings up a whole other angle that wasn't really addressed in the case, the dying declaration exception to hearsay rules.
Wait, so there's a separate exception for statements made by people who think they're about to die? That seems pretty relevant here.
You'd think, right. The idea is that someone facing death, they're not likely to lie.
Right.
So historically, these statements have been considered pretty reliable and admissible in court.
So why didn't that apply to Covington's statement? It seems like a classic dying declaration situation.
It's a good question. Justice Ginsburg pointed out that this exception, even though it's well established, it wasn't properly raised or argued in the lower courts. So because of those procedural issues, this Supreme Court couldn't really weigh in on it.
Wow. So even in a case like this, all these complicated layers of legal rules can have a huge impact on the outcome. It's a bit overwhelming for someone who's not a lawyer, you know.
Yeah.
Can you help connect the dots here? Why should we, the average folks, care about all these legal nuances?
You're right. It's easy to get lost in the details. But the implications of Michigan v. Bryant, they go way beyond this one case. For one thing, it potentially expands that ongoing emergency exception. It gives law enforcement more leeway to admit statements in violent crime cases.
So it could make it easier for prosecutors to use statements that might have been considered inadmissible before?
Exactly. And that raises concerns about, you know, whether things are tipping too far away from a defendant's right to confront their accusers. Critics of the decision, they worry that it prioritizes solving crimes over making sure the process is fair.
That's a big deal. Is there anything else we should be taking away from all of this?
Well, Michigan v. Bryant also highlights this ongoing tension in the legal system, this tension between how reliable a statement is and its testimonial nature. Remember, the Confrontation Clause was designed to prevent unreliable evidence that was obtained without cross-examination from being used in court.
Right. It's about making sure the defendant has a chance to challenge the evidence against them.
Exactly. And some legal scholars argue that by focusing so much on how reliable Covington's statement was and the ongoing danger, the court kind of downplayed the importance of those procedural safeguards.
Okay.
They worry that this could set a precedent for weakening those protections in future cases.
So Michigan v. Bryant isn't just about one murder trial. It raises bigger questions about how we balance public safety with individual rights in our whole justice system.
You got it. It's a case that continues to cause debate in legal circles and has real-world consequences for how criminal cases are handled in courts all over the country.
It really is incredible how one case can bring up so many complex legal issues. As we wrap up our deep dive into Michigan v. Bryant, can you give us like a quick summary of the key takeaways?
Of course. I think the biggest one is how this case really reshaped the ongoing emergency exception to the Confrontation Clause. The court took this much broader view, looking past just the victim's safety and focusing on the potential threat to everyone, the police, the public.
And that broader view has caused some concern, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It potentially gives law enforcement more room to admit statements that might have been tossed out before, and that worries some experts who see it as a possible threat to a defendant's right to confront their accuser.
It does feel like Michigan v. Bryant will have a lasting impact.
Absolutely. It sparked a real debate about the balance between public safety and individual rights, and that debate will probably continue in courtrooms for years to come.
Before we finish up, I have one more question that's been on my mind. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the dying declaration exception to hearsay. What if that had been properly argued in this case? Could that have changed things?
That's a great question. It's tough to say for sure, but it's definitely possible. If the lower courts had considered the dying declaration exception fully and the Supreme Court had been able to weigh in on it, well, we might have a very different legal landscape today.
It's a real what-if moment in legal history. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of our deep dive into Michigan v. Bryant. We've covered a lot of ground from dying declarations to the ins and outs of the Confrontation Clause. I hope you've all gained a better understanding of this landmark case and how it affects our justice system. And if this deep dive has made you want to learn more, I encourage you to keep exploring the world of legal cases. Until next time.